There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods.
Welcome to another Anatomy of a Novel episode. We've covered a range of different genres in this series, including crime with Candice Fox, historical fiction with Kate Forsyth, women's fiction with Monica McInerney, and quite a few more. But we hadn't covered a fantasy novel, so when the opportunity arose to chat to Australian fantasy author Sam Hawke, author of The City of Lies and the sequel in the Poison Wars series, the recently released The Hollow Empire, we jumped at the chance. Sam is the winner of Australia's premier genre prize, the Aurealis Award, plus 2 Ditmar Awards and joint winner of the Norma K. Hemming Award for excellence in exploring issues of gender, race, disability and class in spec fic. Her work features the best ingredients for a superb fantasy series: war, mystery, betrayal and magic. She has taken the US by storm with her debut, and her explosive sequel hit bookstore shelves in December 2020. City of Lies, which is the book that we'll be looking at today, was described in a Guardian review as a compelling fantasy whodunit. Imagine Agatha Christie channeled through Robin Hobb, and a page-turning coming-of-age tale. For this particular Anatomy of a Novel episode, Kel and I decided to call in someone who was well-versed in the genre. Enter Joe Riccioni. Jo is a Sydney-based author who was awarded a Varuna residency and a Bundanon fellowship to work on her first novel, The Italians at Cleet's Corner Store, published in 2015. The book also won the International Rubery Award in 2015 in the UK. Jo is an accomplished short story writer and has now turned her hand to writing a new genre. With a love triangle worthy of The Hunger Games, The Branded Season, is Year of Wonders, The Last Hours and The Handmaid's Tale brought to the fantasy realm and served up with all the romance, conflict and quickfire narrative pace expected by readers of the genre. So with those credentials, Jo is the perfect choice to interview Sam. There's so much gold in here for writers of all genres, not just fantasy. So grab a pen and paper, sit back and listen to Jo Riccioni and Sam Hawke giving us an anatomy of the novel, The City of Lies.
Okay, welcome Sam Hawke to Rights for Women podcast. I'm so happy to have you on the show. This is my first interview for Rights for Women, and I'm really excited because I get to interview a fantasy author that I'm currently reading, which is like unheard of. I haven't had to sort of go and delve looking for the book and read it in 2 days. So I'm really pleased. I'll just give you a little introduction. So for those of you listeners who don't know anything about Sam, she is the writer of a duology known as The Poison Wars duology, potential trilogy. We're not sure yet. The first book, City of Lies, came out a couple of years ago. And the second book, The Hollow Empire, was published in December, so it's very, very new and recent. So fans didn't, have only just had it on the market for a couple of months. So Sam did amazingly well with The City of Lies, winning the Aurealis, Ditmar and Norma K. Hemming Award in one go. So well done, Sam.
But thank you for having me. I'm very excited. Yeah, look, it was a very large surprise, to say the least. I really genuinely did not contemplate winning any of those awards. Particularly the Aurealis Award was a very embarrassing mishap, whereby I did not go to the ceremony because it was in Melbourne, and I didn't really think I could justify the expense of going for an award I definitely wasn't going to win. My very dear friend Devon Madsen was also up for the award and was attending because she lives in the area, and said she would accept for me if I won. However, I did not write an acceptance speech because, again, very convinced I was not going to win. And long and the short of it is I was watching the awards live streamed with my husband in bed, drinking wine, all ready to cheer for the winner. And then, yeah, poor old Devon had to accept the award for me with no speech. And she did a speech for me, which was lovely. And she just had a stream of urgent text from me saying, oh God, I'm so sorry.
How did it make you feel about, this is the awful question, isn't it? The pressure of the second novel.
Oh boy, yeah. Look, the pressure of the second novel is a real thing, and winning awards for the first one does not help.
No, I can imagine.
Because, yeah, like it's hard enough writing a book anyway, but once you've done one, the first one, you're sort of writing for yourself and you don't, I certainly didn't really genuinely believe I was ever going to get it published, because I was very kind of aware of how difficult it is in the industry. And so you don't really have any expectations at all. But with your second one, you've got all these people who are like literally invested in you. You've got your agent and your publisher like financially invested in you, and you have, you know, your family and your friends who have believed in you and supported you and seen you do this great thing that they're very excited about. And of course, you've got like actual readers who like your first book and who want it, you know, you've got to try to keep them happy and satisfied. So yes, it is an expectation ridden terror, really.
And of course, less time given by the publisher.
And time, yes, God, the practical part of it. Yeah, you have unlimited time to write your first book, and you can keep fiddling with it forever. Whereas the second one, you kind of, while you're in the middle of promoting the first one, you have to start doing the second one. And it was a pretty tough learning curve, I think it's fair to say.
I can imagine. You signed a two-book deal, though, so you did know that second book was coming, right?
I did, yes. So City of Lies was originally written as a standalone. I conceived it as a standalone, but when we sold it, my agent sort of said, well, look, fantasy, people like series, so we need to put together a pitch for a second book at least. So we had a kind of high-level pitch for a second book. But then the story, in the editing process, the story changed quite a lot. And that meant that the kind of high level outline I had originally pitched didn't really work anymore. So we had to kind of, you know, do some more, and I didn't have time to do the kind of detailed planning that I'd done with City. Because by the time I got to actually, you know, able to focus on a new thing and put City aside, it was already kind of on the clock. I had the additional extra fun of, my publisher not liking the first version of Hollow Empire, and so me having to basically start from scratch.
Yeah, I heard somewhere that you had to pull out thousands of words, and that was presumably because everything was changing, plots were changing as you went along.
Yeah, well, look, I did a draft that was, first draft that was very much too long, which everyone understood was too long, and then I did a lot of work to sort of cut it down by about a third, which was in itself very difficult, but then the publisher wasn't happy with that version of the book, and I basically had to kind of bin it and start again, which is not to say I didn't poach some things from that book, but I basically had to start with a completely different plot and structure it completely differently. So I feel like I sort of wrote two books for the price of one, which I don't recommend.
And also in this situation where the publisher and or your agent is telling you, we want standalones because publishers don't want to take the risk on trilogies. They're not interested. They want standalone books. But we want you to keep it open to a possibility for some loan. If it sells really well.
Quite common now to buy two. That's really common now. They buy two with that exact thing in mind, which is to say, if it goes well, you keep going. So you have to write these books that are capable of, I call it Schrodinger's sequel, because it's got to be capable of being the end of the series or the middle of the series or, you know, a springboard for further things, which is actually structurally very difficult to do.
It is very difficult to do.
Way. And you often don't know, when you're writing the second book, you don't know how the first book is going to do because it only just came out and you don't get any data in any kind of real time sense.
And of course, because the way time frames work in the publishing industry, you need to have drafted, at least as a minimum, drafted that novel, that second novel, by the time you're doing promos for the first one, right? So ideally, in an ideal world.
Yes.
And I teach creative writing. I don't know, I know you've probably done lots of courses and I've done lots of courses in the past as well. And one of the things that I find really difficult to get across today to beginner writers and people who've like written their first draft is that you might have to write thousands more words before that book is finished. You know, it's not just finishing a draft. It's not just doing NaNoWriMo and finishing a draft. It's actually, that's the bones. And that can be a very depressing thought, I think, for beginner writers. Were you under that misconception when you first started writing, do you think?
No, I'm the sort of opposite. I'm the I will tinker with this thing forever, and it's very difficult to pry anything from my hands as finished. So to me, the prospect of being able to edit over and over again is very comforting because I find drafting quite difficult, and I quite enjoy the editing process. So to me, it's comforting to say, right, if I have this thing down, I can then fiddle with it afterwards for as long as I need to. Well, with the first book.
Not so much with the second book.
So I'm one of the kind of writers who's very well, I mean, particularly with the first book, I never really showed my writing to anybody who wasn't related to me, which meant I didn't actually have a strong sense of whether I was any good at it. Like I was having to rely entirely on my own judgment, which meant, of course, I had a whole imposter syndrome thing going. So you sort of never think that you're good enough. And I like the idea that, you know, you just keep working at it until you're happy. And I kind of had to be prodded into taking the step of actually showing it to anybody. But I can definitely understand you've got to know that it's a long haul process. I suspect for people like me who kind of agonizingly get these drafts out, that's not such a problem because writing has always been a long haul thing for me. Whereas for people who are very, very swift, I imagine it can be confronting to think a thing that it only takes me 3 months to write this thing. It's a bit depressing to think I could still be working on it for another 2 years or something. So it probably, it does depend on your style of writing a bit. I was probably over prepared for how hard the industry was rather than under prepared.
Right. Yeah. Well, that also might be your legal background. You're a lawyer, aren't you, by trade?
I am a lawyer, yep.
Yeah, so you're presumably used to dealing with large quantities of information. Tell us a little bit then about your process before I go delve more deeply into the novel, the second one and the first one. Tell us a little bit about your process as a writer. Do you tend to plot in detail? Or do you kind of wing it a bit, let it grow a bit organically?
I think I can't honestly answer with a definitive statement at this stage in my career because I haven't written enough books, and book one and book two were very different in process. So I don't yet know what's going to be maybe it will be different with every book. But I very much, I like, if left to my own devices, I like to just write things and figure things out as I go. But I do much better if I have an outline. So I guess the answer is I very much like to have the outline done. I just don't like doing it. So City of Lies was very carefully, that was my first experiment at actually, you know, planning a scene by scene book, really, really structuring it in advance and doing that and then writing it. And I loved having the plan done, but I found writing the plan very, very challenging. Whereas with the second book, because as I said, the kind of broad outline we had wasn't really workable anymore by the time the book ended up what it was. I had to kind of conceive of something new. So I only had a very high level idea to work with. You know, kind of the main sort of plot points of the book set out, but none of the interconnective tissue. In terms of having to rewrite it again, I very much had no outline at all and was really just going as I went and figuring things out as I went. All of those methods have worked with varying degrees of success for the particular type of writing that I'm doing. So I think I certainly need to have a sense of what I'm talking about, like what are the kind of themes that I'm thinking about when I'm writing. And I often have the kind of big turning points character-wise for the story, so sort of big character moments I know that I'm building to. But aside from that, I think I like the freedom to kind of let my subconscious guide the planning a bit. And I said that as a writer who's largely writing books that are structured like mysteries, a lot of the time I'm laying clues for things that I'm not aware of at the time. What do you know I mean with those cryptic comments earlier and sort of solve it in reverse, which is a funny way of saying, it's a funny way of doing things, because it's like I'm setting traps for myself, puzzles for myself that I later have to then solve.
The books do come across as highly plotted, like you must have known what was going to happen right from the word go. And, you know, I know I've listened to people like Deborah McTiernan say they plot everything down to the last action of each character. Yeah. But I can't work like that myself, and it sounds like you don't either. You wrote the first engineer and you lay these kind of red herrings, and you think, well, if I don't do anything with that later, I'll edit it out.
Yeah.
But then sometimes you can have really pleasant surprises, can't you, where you just think, that is why I did that 5 months ago, that little detail there, because now I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to run with it.
And I'm not going to lie, that is one of my favourite parts of writing, is when you get to feel like a subtle genius.
Yes,
you realise, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if I did this? And then you look back and you realise that you've laid all of the correct groundwork for that, as though you knew all along.
Yeah.
And like maybe your brain did know all along, and maybe it's just coincidence, but you feel like a genius, and I love that.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your world building, which we have to really talk about with fantasy, because it's such an important element, and it is such a key element for your books, because it's so detailed and so believable. A lot of non-fantasy writers, I think, are under the misconception that fantasy writers don't research, because you're making it all up. You can do whatever you want because it's a fantasy. But clearly that isn't the case with your book. You must have researched some, because there's some very, very strong things around siege warfare, poisoning, citadel structures, architecture, that kind of thing. So tell us a little bit about your world building and research.
Well, look, I do, in fact, love making things up. I'm very lazy. So if I can avoid doing research in favour of making something up, I will absolutely take that option. And I certainly didn't write the kind, like, there's a number of fantasies around that are kind of historical fantasies, in the sense that they're modelled closely on real-world cultures or civilizations, which require vast amounts of research that I'm underqualified to perform. So to some extent, I like to try to not model things off real world things. But having said that, yes, I did have to do quite a bit of reading on sieges and tactics for sieges in terms of both attack and defence, and the kind of weaponry that you'd be capable of using with a given level of technology. The poisoning stuff, I read a lot of stuff about real world poisoning, which I merrily picked and chose what I wanted to use. So for those of you who haven't read any of it, poisoning is obviously a big theme of the stories, because the main characters are from a family whose job is poison testing. So sort of detecting poison is their livelihood. But I did not want to be confined by real world poisons. So all of the flora and fauna in the books is largely fictional. So I had to make up a number of poisons, some of which are based on real world poisons, and I probably know far too much about real world poisons now, and my search history is very suspicious. But yeah, I didn't want to be confined to, well, for a few reasons, I didn't want to be confined to it for plot reasons. So if I wanted to make a substance that did something for plot reasons, I didn't want to be confined by the fact that in the real world, the poison I was basing this on doesn't act that fast or whatever. And I didn't want to be writing a poison instructional manual for anybody either. So I wanted to use like things. And also gives you the advantage that because I was writing a fairly low magic fantasy, you know, people read fantasy partially for the kind of transportive escapism factor, and part of writing in a secondary world is making people feel that. And if you're not writing a very magic heavy fantasy, as I wasn't, one of the ways to make it feel like a different place was by having these sort of unfamiliar flora and fauna. So that was a sort of a little way I could kind of give a depth and richness to the world, and a way that made it feel like not our world without having to rely on supernatural factors. So that was sort of the reasons why I wanted to make up rather than use it in real world ones. But a lot of, because each chapter has a little poison description at the beginning of the chapters, I had to make up a lot more poisons than I actually used in the story.
Yeah.
some of, I will confess that the decision to include those little chapter descriptions came quite late in the piece. And because we did some sort of restructuring of chapters late in the piece as well, I just have a really distinct memory that for some reason something went wrong and we had some missing chapters, or we'd accidentally duplicated chapters. And anyway, I definitely had to do a, like, 1 o'clock in the morning trying to come up with new poisons the last minute. And I was texting my sisters that I need a new name for something, or I needed to do something different. because it starts to feel very same-ish if you, you know, in the real world, a huge proportion of poisons have really similar sort of descriptions. And, you know, poisons generally tend to taste bitter, for example, but you don't want to have a poison description in front of 35 chapters in which the description of what it tastes like is the same every time.
It's the same, yeah.
So, you know, you've got to be a bit creative about, like, what the symptoms are. It can't all just be, like, diarrhea and bloating.
Where did you get the idea of having your protagonists from this family of proofers, they're called, aren't they? Is that a real word? Did you just make that up? It's the people who are poison tasters and have made themselves kind of immune or to a lot of poisons. Where did you get that idea from?
I think I've thought about this a lot because I'm not really sure. I think there was probably a number of factors that kind of crystallized together. But certainly the conception of the book came to me as a set of characters, the brother and sister, who were poison tasters, and they sort of came to me in a single inspiration. But I think a number of things probably fed into it. I have always been kind of interested in the concept of super tasters. So, you know, some people have taste buds that respond very differently to a broader, much broader range of flavors and with more intensity. And some people, I think this probably came up because my husband can eat an insane amount of chili. And it's usually because your taste buds don't respond as well to strong flavors that you can get away with eating things that have really intense flavors, and things that have mild flavors taste flavorless to him. And anyway, so you can be a poor taster or like a super taster, and people can be super tasters with this incredible range. And I did wonder whether, like, what besides making really good wine tasting notes, like what that would be good for, to have, like, when it would be really useful to have, and also, like, if it's a genetic thing, then can it be something that could be bred deliberately for a purpose, and what purpose would that be, and so on. So I had that sort of simmering away. I'd done the usual experiment. I don't know if you did it at school, but in science classes when I was in high school, you usually did the experiment where you taste the chemical that's in caffeine, and some people respond, like, it tastes disgusting to them, and some people are like, yeah, it doesn't taste anything. And those people are the people who can't drink coffee because they taste this chemical that tastes horrible for them.
Tell me a little bit more then about your characters. Really fascinate me because, you know, I read a lot of fantasy, high fantasy, grounded fantasy, you know, magical fantasy, but your characters are what I love about City of Lies and your second book, Hollow Empire, is that your characters are very diverse and they are quite flawed. They have some flaws or challenges as normal people do in real life. So why did you deliberately choose characters like that, or you just found them more fascinating?
Bit of both. I mean, I feel very strongly about the how women are represented in fiction thing. So once again, probably a lot of this subconsciously bubbling away and factoring into how I make decisions, because having said this, I conceived of these characters as a brother and sister exactly as they were. I knew Kalina would have a chronic illness that had made her physically unable to do the proofing duties, and that it would have passed to her younger brother, who I knew had OCD. But I suspect there are some things factored in, one of which is simply that representation of disabilities, mental illnesses and physical illnesses, particularly invisible illnesses, is terrible. It's really poor in fantasy in particular. You get a little bit of mental health representation, but it's usually confined to kind of PTSDs and most common kind of exploration you'll see in fantasy. Chronic illnesses as a main character, pretty unusual. And it's just, the stats are so stacked. So something like 1 in 5 Australian adults has a mental illness. And I think that a chronic condition is even more common than that, something like 1 in 4. So you absolutely know people in your everyday life who have chronic illnesses or mental illnesses or both, but you just don't see them represented. Or you see them represented, but it's a plot point that this is a thing, as opposed to just a reflection of the world that we live in.
Yeah.
And, you know, fantasy is getting much better at being diverse in a whole range of ways. Certainly much better in representing women than it was when I was first reading fantasy, you know, 30 plus years ago. But it really is still lagging in terms of disability rep. And, you know, people with disabilities deserve to see themselves reflected in fiction as the heroes. And to not have every story just be about overcoming their challenges or seeking a magical cure or anything. They just get to be the heroes sometimes. That was important to me. And in terms of the representation of women, as a person who grew up very much in the tough tomboy, I don't like girly things mode, I'm a much better feminist now that I was as a young person, because I've very much learned to recognize the not like other girls thing as another way that the patriarchy hurts us. So I kind of have like a litmus test now, which is that it's a sewing test. If a book tells me that a girl is an important main character hero because she doesn't like sewing like those other girls, that's enough to really put me off a book now. Because it's a kind of lazy shorthand for girly things are bad. Sewing is a girly thing, and people who like girly things aren't as important or good or deserving to be the heroes as people who like boy things. And firstly, there aren't any boy things or girl things, but things that are represented have been linked traditionally to the feminine side. I don't think it's very feminist to write books where those things are slagged on, because that's just another way of enforcing their patriarchal notions that harm us all. I did intentionally set out to kind of explore different kinds of strength. So, you know, they use that expression, the strong female character, and that doesn't have to mean strong like can beat everybody up. And in some ways that can be a challenge for me, because as I said, I was very much a kind of tomboy. Martial arts is
You have a jiu-jitsu kind of background, don't you? Is it jiu-jitsu?
Jiu-jitsu, Japanese jiu-jitsu is my main love. That's where I hold a black belt in, and my husband and I run a jiu-jitsu club together.
Wow.
And our kids are in it and stuff. My husband was my black belt training partner. So like martial arts has been it, but I started with karate when I was younger. And I've also I also do judo and Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and I've done kabuto and a whole range of Krav Maga and a whole bunch of things over time, because martial arts has always been a big deal to me, and I love that stuff, and I very much related to all those stories growing up of girls forced into social roles that they didn't want when they really wanted to be. The Arya Stark characters are very easy for people to relate to, people like me, but I think it's more, they're very well represented in fantasy now in a way that women with a different kind of strength are less so. So I did make, certainly both subconsciously and deliberately, those kind of notions played into me wanting to make a hero who couldn't fight her way out of situations and had to use skills that were traditionally considered feminine. Emotional intelligence is a big
she's a diplomat factor.
She's the one who kind of understands the other characters and can accurately predict what's happening based on those sort of social skills, the softer skills, and also it's plot relevant that she's good at sewing. So
I do like the fact that incidentally the commander of the armies of Celesta happens to just be a woman, so that was nice.
Very much set out to make it a gender.
Yeah, and it wasn't showcased. It was just, this is the fact that Arvin is the commander, and that's the way it should be. It should be just incidental.
It's really hard, and you kind of fall into habits. Even when you really care about these things, you can fall into habits of, I made sure my main cast was split between male and female. There's one point of view character for each, and the kind of two main subsidiary characters are one man and one woman. But it's very easy to just sort of slip into the habit of making background characters default to male, because that's how we're kind of trained to think and see on screen and so on. Consciously drawing back when you're writing and thinking, wait, no, why am I assuming that background character is male? Make sure it's cast. And it's actually really funny because the cast is 50-50 in terms of background and main characters.
Yeah.
My very favorite negative review of my book is basically along the lines of, there are just too many women. Everywhere we look, there are women. They think about someone, it's a woman. There's just too many. I like strong female characters, but this is too much. And it just made me laugh so hard, because it's like a written, like a, the personification of that, I think it's Dale Spencer's study from a while back, where they studied university classes and found that when women are talking 17% of the time, men perceive it as equal. And when they're talking like 30% of the time, they perceive it as women dominating a conversation. And so like, this guy's like a walking, talking personification of that study, where if your book is 50-50 across the board, he will perceive that as obscenely overtaken by women. Anyway, that always makes me laugh. It's my favorite review.
You've done a really good job, and you've done a good job, I think, of not, making it a soapbox issue. It's actually comes across very naturally in the book, which, maybe because I'm a woman reader, but I thought that came across really naturally, which is...
Oh, thank you. It's very important to me, and it's something I would like to see more of in fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're so creative about these worlds that we're building, and people can conceive of all of these incredible magic powers and magical creatures and all of these wonderful, intricate things. But then we so often kind of just replicate so many defaults from our current world without thinking. And one of those is a patriarchal society. And given that we're making up societies from scratch, there's just no reason that every society has to be patriarchal. There's definitely a place for stories in which, you're examining those ideas of patriarchy and, showing them from the perspective of somebody in that situation fighting against injustices. Of course, that's an important kind of story to tell. But we also kind of need stories as well where, what if it just isn't a thing? Conceiving of a world in which, this patriarchy isn't actually a thing here. Like there was, in my case, because I structured the world, and this is all again sort of retrofitted. I started with characters, and then I built the world that I thought made sense for those characters to be in the way I wanted them to be.
Oh, right, that was my next question, actually. Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
I very much started with a pair of siblings and their job, and I built everything out from there. And because I knew that I wanted to tell a story that really centered that sibling relationship, I kind of started from the perspective of, well, okay, what kind of society might have a really strong emphasis on sibling relationships prioritizing those over romantic relationships? And so I built a society in which it's matrilineal, because there's no emphasis on romantic relationships, there's no concept of marriage, Families are built around, your siblings. Women have children and raise them with their blood families, not with a romantic partner. And if you start from that perspective, it's just amazing and so much fun, really, to think about all the ripple effects of how that changes how yeah. people interact. Like if you start from a position that if you take just taking marriage out of the equation as a social construct, has all of these fun ramifications. One of which is that it really just by itself dismantles a lot of the patriarchy if there's no concept of marriage, because women's value isn't determined by reference to the men that they're linked to, and there's no social power in sort of moving women from one family group to another. That's not a way you transfer power or money or property. That just really changes how romantic relationships work in the society. And if there's no social gain and no financial gain from a permanent relationship with particular people from particular backgrounds, then that changes how these relationships form and how they're valued and so on. So it's really, really interesting. And again, something that I wish we'd see explored in fantasy more often.
Yeah.
Because how we form families and our social groups and how relationships are ranked is a big factor in how the whole world works, basically.
Yeah.
How you structure government. And like you said, like who takes particular jobs and so on is not an issue if there's no kind of rigid gender roles based around family groups.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. Having said that, though, Jovan's romantic relationship with El Hadriat, she kind of complements his condition, doesn't she, in a way, because she's very grounded and she has that connection to the old religion. And that's the concept I really like in a lot of fantasy, is the fact that, we'll talk about what references you have for your world in a minute, but this construct of the old religion that you create in the Poison Wars geology, being linked to care for the land, honor, and that the city of Celestia has actually lost that connection to the deeper understanding of caring for the land and caring for traditions. And do you want to talk a little bit more about that and where that came from?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously a big theme of both books is about societies having to grapple with their past mistakes. And part of that is just a sense of, a feeling that in fantasy often we look at restoring the status quo as the goal point, which is a bit of a it can be old fashioned. It can mean that you kind of uphold old fantasy can be quite conservative, I guess, is what I'm getting at. In that often a lot of the time is you sort of trade with this idea of rightful rulers and things that disrupt the status quo that need to be defeated to return to the status quo. Like lost heirs to fix the problem and that sort of thing, which is obviously not all fantasy, but it's a prevailing theme. I kind of am a bit dissatisfied with that as a model to look at, because just it's more interesting to sort of think about how societies move forward rather than return to status quo or stagnate. And in terms of moving forward, like how do you deal with the things that you've done wrong and get better? Because ultimately, I'm trying to write optimistic fantasy.
Yeah.
I think I'm, like many people, probably burned out a bit on real world negativity. And so certainly there's a driving force to make my stories more hopeful, which is not to say that they're light and fluffy. Because obviously, they're called the Poison Wars.
Yeah.
So people die and horrible things happen.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I want people to come away with a sense that these are stories about people trying to do better, and a little bit about like what doing better looks like. So, in terms of the first book was very much about some good-hearted but blinkered people living in a society that, in many ways, was progressive. Excellent on gender relations and you know, honouring a lot of things that I think are important, like the arts and science, and, you know, kind of this idea of a civilised city that that doesn't glorify violence, and that is, you know, trying to be, you know, as multicultural and accepting and vibrant as possible.
He uses this concept of guilders, which I really like, the guilder of, you know, entertainment and performance, the guilder of, you know.
Yeah,
which kind of reminded me a little bit of, you know, I guess old Holland, kind of, the way they had guilds, which I thought was a nice way of, you know, organising society, the society. But, of course, it's a very privileged society, isn't it, as well?
Sorry, that's right.
Yeah, so...
And usually privilege comes from oppression. And usually if one group of people are doing very well, it's often at the expense of somebody else. And so in this case, because I'd sort of created this city, I wanted to think about, I wanted to tell a story about what you kind of do when you realise that a lot of the good things that have come to you, it's not fair, basically, that you're in it. And then part of that comes from the real world position of, you know, being a privileged white person in 2020 and accepting, particularly in Australia, that you are privileged at the expense of the original occupants of this land. And, you know, that's something that that white people in particular have to deal with and accept, that, you know, that we've got substantial privileges that have come at the expense of other people, and that we need to examine and challenge and dismantle those systems in order to be better and to move forward and make the world fairer. So I was sort of telling a story about that in a way. In terms of how I kind of conceived of the, you know, I just really love like old mysterious magic returning as a theme, a trope.
I
dig that. I'm much more, I very much like kind of poorly understood mysterious soft magic, more than the kind of hard rules, magic side of things, which that's just a personal preference. I enjoy the idea of like something you don't understand or fully control.
You have one concept which I really loved in the first book, which was the idea of people romantically, you know, having sex or making love at a point of high magical or spiritual locations, which then kind of woke the god beneath the and I kind of loved that idea. I thought, oh, what a great idea.
The magic system to emotion rather than kind of intellectual decisions. The magic in the world is connected to heightened emotion of all kinds. And I'm trying to do this without spoilers, but obviously that's relevant to what happens in the book. Again, because kind of emotions have this sort of sense of unpredictability and vulnerability, which I think I just find interesting as a concept. So that was mostly I think it's cool as part of the world building, which is a very important part of my world building. Do I think it's cool? Yes, I think it's cool. In it goes.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it does, I don't know whether you subconsciously did that, but it's a nice balance to Jovan, who struggles with his emotions, right? He can't, because he's OCD, he has to keep really, really tight control over his emotions. Whereas El Hadjia can naturally get in touch more with that kind of old world magic, which is rooted in emotion and feeling, which I thought was a kind of nice balance. So I don't know whether you did that on purpose or not.
In many ways, Hadjia is meant to be a foil to the other characters, because she's sort of the person who comes in from the outside perspective and can kind of put a mirror on them, basically. So through her eyes, they're kind of able to sort of see some of their own limitations. And also just as a kind of a, she was the most fun character to write, because much as I love Jove and Kalina, and I do love them very dearly, they can be, you know, they're very intense. Jove in particular, because of their job, you know, they're raised to protect a person, and they're raised in a circumstance where their sense of self and sense of honour, which is, you know, the most important social currency they have, is tied to this particular job. And, you know, the book begins with their family kind of failing at that.
Yeah.
So they start from a position of deep, you know, imbalance, and they're kind of flailing along. And Jove, by his nature, is very introspective, and he has to deal with the kind of intrusive thoughts that are part of OCD, which can mean, if you don't know much about OCD, intrusive thoughts are sort of unwelcome thoughts that you become fixated on. One of the most sort of difficult and upsetting parts of the condition, in that people with OCD can sometimes, you know, perceive think of a bad thing, and then become obsessed with the idea of that thing, and then you get into a horrible loop where you kind of think that you're thinking that thing because you want it to happen, and therefore you're a bad person, and so it's a horrible kind of emotional thing. And a lot of OCD ritualized behavior is kind of about managing fears of something going wrong if you don't do XYZ. And so, you know, the compulsions in OCD are generally linked to behaviors that you're doing to try to avoid a bad thing. Bad thing is irrational, but you have kind of built a pattern that if you don't perform a particular ritual, then the bad thing will happen, and so you can't afford not to do that, and so on. Anyway, so that sort of naturally makes a character who is in his own head a lot. And, you know, they started the book with a position of deep ignorance about how their country actually works and its history. And Hadria gets to kind of come in and be the refreshing person who calls them on their BS, basically. So she gets to come in and tell them when they're behaving in a way that's centering their problems instead of the main problems. And she gets to just be a foil to their, she's impulsive, as you say, very grounded with her emotions, and she'll say what she thinks, and she's not kind of bound by the same social construct. And it's just so refreshing. It's so refreshing to write after these kind of agonizing, anxiety-ridden characters. It's refreshing to have somebody who knows who she is completely confident in who she is, and what she wants.
Do you ever find that your characters start to take over and sort of do things you weren't planning, that they start to do things you hadn't planned for them, or say things that, you know, your characters can actually take on a bit of a life of their own? Do you experience that at all?
Yeah, so as a kind of a broad starting point, I'm in charge and I make things happen to the characters rather than them making things happen to me. But having said that, like you say, when you are kind of deep in the drafting process, often, and I think this is part of like what we were talking about earlier, I think my subconscious knows what it's doing a lot more than my conscious mind does at times. So someone will surprise you with how they respond in a scene, or you've intended a scene to go a particular way, and then when you go to write it, it doesn't work because the character, it doesn't feel right for the character, and they would do something else, and you can't necessarily see that objectively. I'm certainly not the kind of person who feels very, like, who gets a complete sense of the character, has conversations with them or dreams about them or anything. That's very much not me. I'm kind of a bit more on the cynical and practical side, I think.
They've got to do a function at some point. They've got to serve a purpose or
that's right. And like, if they're well, obviously, if you've done a good job of making a character who feels believable, then you should have a really strong sense of how they would act in a particular situation, even if you haven't thought about it in advance, which I guess is really just a different way of looking at what everyone experiences, which is that when they're writing.
When you're in a writer's group, Sam, do you critique each other's work, or are you with a, you know, steady group of people who work together?
Only my sister, basically.
Okay.
The only person who's kind of consistently read everything I've written soon after I write it is my younger sister. But as I said, I was a very solitary writer before I was published. I didn't have any writing friends. It was just me and my sister. And then when I was ready to kind of put the book out to publish, I let like my parents and my other sister and my brother and a couple of good friends read the book for their views. And that was a big deal for me because writing was not a thing I sort of talked about with other people. That's not true, sorry. I had one friend that I'd made on a writing board years before, and she was kind of my only writing friend, but we weren't, I was not really sending her writing. So I'd help her with editing and things, but it was kind of more one more one way because I wasn't producing, at the time when we became friends, I wasn't really producing much creative content myself. I was sort of helping other people. Yeah, I really didn't have a writing group or writing pals or anything when I first went into the industry, which is why I sort of, you sometimes see advice about people saying, you know, you have to know people in the industry in order to get a full time. I mean, that's just patently nonsense. You absolutely don't need to know anybody. You can be a complete social outcast like me and not have any writing friends or anything. So when I first started querying, I didn't know anybody, really. I didn't know anybody before I published a book and entered the industry. And now I have lots of friends. I have a group of people who, you know, once I felt the, I said before about imposter syndrome, I didn't even feel like I could. There's a lovely local group of science fiction and fantasy writers in Canberra. It's the SFG Guild, basically, the Speculative Fiction Guild. And they're great. And I was too, I didn't feel confident enough to join until I literally had an agent for a book. That was when I finally felt like, oh, okay, I will try to be part of the community. It was a real deal for me. And so I finally joined that after I had an agent. And so now I have many local friends who I know. And I now have a kind of group of other authors who write fantasy who debuted about the same time as me, thereabouts. So 2018, 2019 debuts, who we all kind of know each other and have a Discord and chat. And it's just invaluable. Like knowing people in the industry who are going through the same sort of stage in their careers as you is like, if I literally offer writing advice to anybody, you can figure out craft stuff, heaps of stuff online available, but like my number one tip is actually like just find some friends. Like you need friends, and it makes everything about this crazy business better having friends. And so now I have like other awesome authors who are willing to, you know, read my writing for me. So for the second book, I was able to have, you know, beta readers, like, you know, Shannon Chakraborty or Anna Stevens.
Wow.
Like people who were, you know, writers that I love, actually reading my work.
That's amazing.
Totally invaluable, but yeah, no. For the first lot, I didn't have that.
So, is there going to be a third book, or what's the deal? Are you doing something new?
So, I mean, the short answer is I don't know for sure.
Would you like to do something different? I mean, I suspect you would. Yeah.
So, in the knowledge that that no final decisions have been made at this stage. I have been working in the meantime on an entirely separate thing with the knowledge that I may at some point, if things went well, write a third book. So, you know, I still have the kind of end game book three ideas floating around there, and book two very much can be the end, but I have kind of left the room for the next stage if I wanted to, but I mean at this stage I suspect probably it won't happen, or at least not for a while, so I'm still working on the assumption that probably not. So the new thing I'm working on is entirely separate, and it is nice to, you know, do something different and be somewhere else.
And your new, I read somewhere, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I read somewhere that your new book is Hades Town mixed with Les Mis and ghosts.
Hades Town meets Les Mis, but with
ghosts. Because my favourite musical is Hades Town. She's going to be very excited.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, so it's kind of like the rescuing someone from hell.
Orpheus in the underworld.
Industrial Revolution kind of feel to Hades Town. And Les Mis, the kind of rising of the underclass. But there are angry ghosts.
That sounds amazing. I love it already.
Oh, thank you. I'm having a lot of fun with it.
I do love the fact that fantasy is going down this route. It seems to me anyway that there's a lot of genre mashing going on in fantasy at the moment. Do you feel that yourself? I mean, I know that I feel like your book is a bit of a genre mash really, in terms of although it's kind of, you know, it has a kind of medievalish fantasy setting, it is a murder mystery, it's a siege novel. It's
definitely a genre mashup.
And I don't know, tell me what you think of this. This is my theory. Publishers kind of want you to do the same again if it's a winning kind of story and they've sold a lot of copies. They kind of want you to replicate that again. But for most writers, you want to move on to the new thing. You want to do a new thing. So once they've pegged you as a fantasy writer, and it's probably the same for romance writers, same for mystery thriller writers, you know, once they've pegged you in that hole, you kind of can't get out, really.
Yeah, no, that's a real issue with traditional publishing for sure. And like I said, like publishers, the traditional publishers, they're big, you know, multinational companies, they're legacy companies, you know, they're extremely conservative. If they've got something that is selling, they want you to keep selling that thing. Of course they do, because they don't want to take risks with these. And this is part of what we're saying before about like two-book contracts, that you've got to be willing to just keep writing them if it does well, because they don't want to take a chance on something new if they've got a proven formula. And that's very much true. And that's very true in terms of, yeah, how genres develop as well, because, yeah, like why take a chance on a new kind of thing when you don't know and you could just produce more of the same? That's definitely an issue with traditional publishing. And I think a lot of people get around that literally just by using pen names. So, you know, I know a number of fantasy writers who are also romance writers, or you know, write military sci-fi under a different name or whatever. And in traditional publishing, there's a kind of a real push. Publishers hate you doing that. They'd love you to just stick with the same thing, with the same branding, this whole branding thing, which is kind of deeply uncomfortable to me and to probably most writers. There's this sort of issue that once you get big enough and successful enough, it's a great thing, but it kind of limits you in a way as to what you're kind of allowed to do or encouraged to do. And like obviously once you get this sort of levels, that once you're past a certain point, you do whatever the hell you want. Very few writers are really in that position to do that. And so realistically what happens is if you're a traditional publishing, you just have to have different names to do it. But like people definitely feel like, in fact, I was on a panel the other day with it was a behind the scenes discussion, but I was watching a subsequent one on the same con where people were talking about, the pressure to do more, but the desire to try something different, especially for young writers and sort of writers early in their careers who don't yet know what kind of stories they want to write. You know, you tend to be attracted to the things that you like to read. City is definitely a closed room mystery in fantasy clothes. But I mean, part of the reason why I love fantasy is that regardless of how people characterize it and put it in shelves and bookshelves and so on, I think fantasy is a setting more than it is a genre. Because fantasy stories can be adventure stories, they can be quest stories or coming of age stories, they can be mysteries, they can be romances, they can be anything. If you're putting it in a setting that contains supernatural elements or is set in a different world, you're in the fantasy zone. But the actual structure of the story doesn't have to be a particular formula to make it fantasy. So in that way, it's different to sort of other genres.
I think it's full flexibility
to tell whatever kind of story you want. So fortunately, because I deeply love fantasy, and that's my favorite genre to read, it's always been my favorite genre to read. So I feel no pressure to kind of write in other genres, but the kind of books I want to write might well change. It'll just be that they will always have a fantasy hint.
Yeah.
So I've got a good friend who is currently writing, because she's amazingly prolific, obscenely, unfairly so. You know, I struggle with one book at a time and she's handling like six. But, you know, she's writing epic fantasies, and she's also writing middle-grade adventure stories, and she's writing romance, contemporary romance. And it's just like this list of different things that she's just able to juggle these projects. And I'm incredibly impressed with anyone who's able to do that.
That's amazing. Okay.
Like you said, like fantasy is becoming, it's much more common now to see fantasy stories openly being something, really something else. I'm reading at the moment The Helm of Midnight by Marina Lestetta, an advanced copy of a book that's coming out in March, I think, which is a serial killer mystery. It's a serial killer thriller. It just, again, wearing fantasy clothes, but that's the kind of story it is. The hunt by law enforcement for a serial killer. So, like, people who like the kind of thriller stories in a contemporary sense, it has all of the same kind of elements. It's just it just looks different.
Shout out for a recent female fantasy writer that you've read. You just mentioned someone who's got a book coming out. Is there another one?
I have so many. So many. I I actually didn't read very much last year for many reasons.
Yeah.
2020 in general, but also some health reasons. But I did get to Tasha Suri's absolutely exquisite Jasmine Throne, mm-hmm. which is due out later this year, and it's just magnificent. Really just fierce and magical and challenging, and she's got so much to say about cultures and how we grapple with conflicts in culture. And she's an amazing writer. Her books, Empire of Sand and Realm of Ash, are already out, and they're wonderful, and I love those. But this is next level stuff. It's really great. And Shannon Chakraborty, who I mentioned before, wrote the David Badd trilogy, which I absolutely adore. Start with City of Brass. Those are complete and wonderful. And she's working on the coolest sounding adventure about a retired woman who goes back to her piracy career later in life, which is awesome. Fonda Lee, and if you've read the Greenbone saga, the third one of that due out this year.
Yeah.
And those are just so cool. They're like, like a Hong Kong martial arts movie mixed with gangster sort of aesthetics in a fantasy setting. They're modern and smart and really deeply great.
Last piece of advice for debut writers or beginner writers, a favourite writing book or a favourite piece of advice that you want to put out there to the listeners?
I think I said this before, but I absolutely think find a group of friends, have a private space to talk to those friends, which will enable you to, like, get key information about what's going on in the industry, because it's a really opaque and strange industry, and no one really understands it except for people who are in it, and even then, iffy. And also it means that you have somewhere private to vent when inevitably ridiculous things happen or terrible things happen, and it stops you writing those things on Twitter and getting yourself in trouble. Vent to your friends, not to the public.
Good advice.
Honestly, like it is genuinely the bit of advice I think is the most valuable, because you can figure everything else out, and you'll get better at writing literally just by writing and reading. You'll kind of get better on your own, even if you never read a craft book. You just read things that you admire and you know, think about what they do well, and you will just get better kind of as a process. But you can't replicate the benefits you get from having people who understand and who you can talk things out, like both in a craft sense and in a business sense. It's just, it's the only thing that kind of it makes the industry bearable, really. Yeah. Like it's a dreadful industry in many ways. But your friends make it bearable. There was that thing that went around on Twitter a few days ago about other authors being your competition, not your friends, and it's like the most absurd thing I've ever read, because especially other authors don't view other writers as your competition. We're all in this together, and people don't read just one book. People who like reading and read good books want to read more good books.
Yeah,
Don't go into the industry with the view that people are your, like, the view to make enemies.
From the fans' perspective, if they've read good book, you know, if they read one good book, they want another good book like it. Exactly. And not just from you, but from many, many other writers.
Exactly. Unless you can write enough books a year to satisfy everyone's entire reading palette, which is not really going to be possible, then you don't need to worry about that. You don't need to worry about that.
Absolutely.
It's very much a social industry, and it's very much important to be able to, like I know I said, it doesn't matter who you know. It doesn't matter who you know when you're getting started, but it does matter as you go in general. Just your own mental health is nothing else. You need to kind of know what's going on in the industry and have people to talk to, because no matter how awesome and supportive your family are, if they're not writers, they don't really get this nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Don't be like me. Don't be a hermit. Make friends.
All right, Sam Hawke, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about fantasy, about your two books, City of Lies and Hollow Empire. I wish you the best of luck with that second book, and we're all very, very interested to see what you come up with next.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Rights for Women podcast. If you enjoyed listening, we would really appreciate it if you could head over to wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rating or review so that other people can find us too. If you want to hear more brilliant conversations with great writers, you can head to our website, www.rightsforwomen.com, where you can catch all the episodes from the Convo Couch and the Anatomy of a Novel series, as well as the Book Launch, a season of episodes created to help authors launch their books in isolation.
And while you are there, why don't you check out our Patreon page? Patreon is how people can support the artists making the work they love. So if you love Rights for Women and want to support us in supporting other authors, become a Patreon subscriber and get some cool little bonuses while you're at it. To everyone who is already a subscriber, we appreciate your passion for our project and thank you very much. You can always find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. Thank you for staying home and supporting our authors. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.